Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Fair Housing Act and Persons with Disabilities conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star, then one on your telephone. If you require any further assistance, please press star, then zero. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Mr. Peter Berg from the Great Lakes ADA Center. Please go ahead, sir.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for the introduction there, Sydney. And welcome to the September ADA audio conference session. This is the final session in the 2018-29 season of the ADA Audio Conference Series. The ADA Audio Conference Series is the longest educational program of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is the leader in providing information on the Americans with Disabilities Act. There are 10 regional ADA centers around the country. You can find the center that serves your state by visiting adata.org. or calling 800-949-4232 to connect with your regional ADA center. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. So, with that, we are pleased to have with us Amanda Motika, who is with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And while the focus of the national network is on the ADA, we also get a good number of questions regarding the Fair Housing Act and the rights of people with disabilities when it comes to housing. What are the rights of people with disabilities? What are the obligations of housing providers? Homeowners association, condo associations, when it comes to people with disabilities. So we are pleased that Amanda has joined us today. Amanda Motika is the Equal Opportunity Specialist with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development here in the Chicago office. Amanda joined us a few years back to do a session that we did specifically on service and assistance animals. That topic, I'm sure, will come up today during her presentation. Just as a quick reminder, for those of you in the webinar room, you can submit questions while Amanda is speaking, and even though you can't see those questions when you submit them, they are viewable by us on this end, so we will get to those questions once Amanda has worked through her presentation. And again, just as a reminder, today's session is being recorded. So that's enough of me. Amanda, thank you very much for joining us today, and we're looking forward to all the great information that you have to share with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Peter. I really appreciate it. And as Peter said, I've been working for the Department of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity now for about 4 years. Prior to that, I was in housing, working for the Chicago Housing Authority for approximately 11 years, doing disability work there as well. So I wanted to take a real brief moment just to kind of acknowledge how I got into working with people with disabilities. And I think a lot of people would maybe have the same story, and that kind of centered around Marka Bristow, who I met in 2005 when I started working with the Chicago Housing Authority. You know, upon her death last week, it just made me kind of reflect back about her impact on the country and accessibility, and upon me and her work and dedication to disability justice, which I think we all will never forget. So with that, I just kind of want to take you through, you know, fair housing and how it affects people with disabilities. And so we'll give a little background here about what exactly we're talking about when we talk about fair housing. So I found this definition, and I think it is pretty relevant. There are so many definitions for what fair housing is, but it's basically the right for all people to live where they choose, to have access to housing, seek purchase, selling or renting it, and to enjoy the full use of their homes without unlawful discrimination, interference, coercion, threats, or intimidation by owners, landlords, real estate agents, or any other persons. So fair housing, to me, is the assurance that anyone retains their agency over their own choices on where to call home. So the beginnings of fair housing, if we can go back to the late 1960s, right after the assassination of President Kennedy, we had, you know, of course, President Johnson take over. And later on, it's kind of a weird time in America. And there's, you know, upheaval and riots. So President Johnson convened what it came to be called the Kerner Commission to investigate why the entire country seemed to be, you know, rioting and in a state of upheaval. So, you know, from our history, we know there were race riots in Detroit, Watts in Los Angeles, and unrest and violence in Chicago and New Jersey. So what the Kerner Commission kind of summed up in their research was what the state of the country was to them, and that was that our nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. So there began to be a push for legislation to stop such, you know, riots from occurring. And everyone started kind of lobbying around the Fair Housing Act, which wasn't getting much support until, unfortunately, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In 1968. So what we did get from the Fair Housing Act is one of the most aggressive and powerful civil rights laws that we have, even currently in the country. There's unique language requiring HUD and the government, or HUD and government recipients of HUD money to affirmatively further fair housing. I know this has become a little controversial because we actually no longer are looking at, you know, what we have done a couple years ago with affirmative housing plans and things like that. But essentially, what affirmatively furthering fair housing is it's never just status quo. We're always looking towards how to best integrate and desegregate neighborhoods in the United States. So at the time that it was passed, there were only a few classes that were covered. So race and color, national origin, religion, and then later on, sex was actually added, I believe, in 1974. The Fair Housing Amendment Act of 1988 is basically what we're going to talk about today. So that added protections for people with disabilities and family with children, which you'll hear phrased as familial status, in the sale of rent, in the sale or rental of housing. We quickly saw disability surpassed race as the most frequently cited protected class in HUD complaints. Up until, you know, when it first was enacted, a lot of the Fair Housing Act complaints were strictly race-related. And then in 2007, as the slide says, you know, we'll see disability almost become 60% of the cases that we'll see. As we all know, a person is disabled if he or she has a physical or mental impairment, a record of such an impairment, and if that impairment substantially limits one or more major life activities. This includes people who use wheelchairs or other kind of mobility aids, you know, people who use glasses and other things that kind of mitigate these disabilities, and people who are hearing or visually impaired. Also people who have HIV/AIDS, and this, I would say, is more recent, and people who are obese. So it's not just the, you know, that you are physically obese, it's that you have disabilities that stem from obesity. People in recovery from alcohol or drug abuse are also covered, but not active users. Okay, and so what I included in this slide, and you can use moving forward if you'd like. It's not working today, but is one of the commercials that Fair Housing had created. And in the short video, kind of just will show that there is a tenant who is looking to rent an apartment who seems to be perfect on paper. Good credit score, referrals from landlords and things like that. And it's a white male. And then he kind of morphs into, different classes. So a Latinx person, African American, a woman with children, and a man using a wheelchair. So important to kind of see that discrimination is insidious. Oftentimes there's not going to be, we hardly ever see overt discrimination. Likely no one's going to tell you when you go to rent an apartment that, no, you're in a wheelchair, I'm not renting to you. But they may find and sometimes find other things to say and other reasons why they're not going to rent the apartment to you. An interesting thing, too, that we have seen kind of disappointingly, we find that the discrimination now happens even by phone and even through emails. So someone, a landlord that you're looking to rent from may stereotype a voice that they hear and may also look at emails that are sent and pick up things about maybe your email name. So if your email address, has something either that would denote, your race or your sex or something like that, we see sometimes that that's used to discriminate persons that are looking to rent housing or buy housing. Okay, so like I said, the protected classes for the Fair Housing Act, and these are very different from what you hear state and locally protected. So we take complaints that are race, color, sex, religion, national origin, disability, and familial status based. There has been, kind of an influx of states that have added upon that. So, for instance, in the slide that I have now, this is talking about Illinois. And so you see the inclusion of sexual orientation, ancestry, marital status, order protection, things like this. And then even in the city of Chicago, they recently did source of income, which was important because we have a lot of users of Section 8 vouchers. One thing that we'll kind of discuss later is, kind of restrictions on filing complaints if you feel you've been discriminated against. And that's what the deadlines at the bottom are talking about. So you have 1 year to file with HUD and 180 days for some of the other things, as you can see under the deadlines. And IDHR, that's the Illinois Department of Human Rights here in Illinois. And you may have that if you're in different states. You may have what we call substantially equivalent agencies that may be like Ohio Department of Human Rights, things like that. And they actually, what we call complaints under fair housing are, it's a Title VIII complaint, if you've ever heard that. And under that statute, we can refer those to these agencies to actually investigate for us. I hope that wasn't too much information to throw at you on one thing. So, sorry.
Amanda, if you could just give a heads up of the slide number that you're working on, please.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. And so I just changed to slide 17, talking about what someone can't do to you, and this is based on your protected class. So when we're talking about the Fair Housing Act, we look at somebody refusing to sell or rent a dwelling, refusing to negotiate for the sale or rental, discriminating in the terms, conditions, or privilege of the sale or rental. And sometimes these things need, maybe we need to go into a little bit further, but we were talking about different terms and conditions. You know, it could be a whole lot of things. So one would be maybe requesting a larger deposit for somebody who comes in using a wheelchair, on the assumption that, you know, there may be more wear and tear to a unit. So things like this are completely illegal. But that's, you know, that's some of the things that landlords sometimes feel like they can do. And then also discriminating in the services or facilities in connection with the sale or rental of a dwelling. And so on slide 18, kind of talk about what else. What else can't, you know, is illegal to do when under the Fair Housing Act. So making, printing, or publishing advertisements that indicate a preference, limitation or discrimination, you know, so looking for people, you know, who are under a certain age or singles only, so, you know, no children, things like that. We've seen kind of an uptick in discriminating in lending or appraisals. We're kind of back where we were, unfortunately, like, you know, 2008, 2009, with some of these, with some of the loans that are being kind of offered to people of color and other protected classes. Also misrepresenting the availability of a property. So, again, like I was saying, if someone calls and, you know, for lack of a better word, sounds white, and I say, sure, yeah, it's available. Why don't you come over tomorrow and look at it? But I have, you know, my friend who is black call, and they, you know, say, no, sorry, you know, that's been rented. Steering. So we see this sometimes with real estate agents who tell people, you know, you may be more comfortable living, you know, near X instead of, you know, where you actually are looking to rent or buy a property. Also, a big one, refusing to allow a reasonable accommodation or modification for people with disabilities. And then looking at when somebody has exercised their right for fair housing, retaliation once somebody is notified that there's been a complaint filed. And, of course, like everything on slide 19, there are some exemptions from the Fair Housing Act. They're very limited. And so you see that in small owner-occupied buildings. So if I own, you know, a two flat and I'm living there, you know, these rules may not apply to you. Individuals who own three single-family homes or less at any one time. We get questions all the time about senior housing. So, you know, we actually at HUD, when I say we, I'm sorry, HUD can designate a property as 62 and older or 55 and older. And there are restrictions on, you know, how many families they can rent to that are within that age group. But what we're talking about is, say I rent the unit to somebody who is 62, but they have custody of their grandchild. There are protections for that family. So although I have to rent to families that contain somebody that are 62 and older or 55 and older, if they're coming with people who are under that age limit, then I cannot discriminate and say that, you know, they can't live in the senior housing. Things we've been seeing less of, but that were at one time very popular, were, you know, religious organizations. So you had to be of a certain religion to live on, you know, certain properties. And again, kind of a disclaimer: the laws differ. And also, you know, if you have any questions about if it's applicable, you can always contact HUD to see if that is one of the exemptions that you're dealing with. So on slide 20, a big thing that's happened, so FHEO successfully sued Facebook in 2019. I'm not sure if everyone's aware, but I think we all, you know, maybe against our better judgment, have Facebook accounts. And what they were doing was some of the things that I had just spoken about. So, you know, they had ads on there that were, you know, looking for people of a certain type and just kind of outright discriminatory were you know, on Facebook. Ultimately, Facebook was found liable because they were kind of permitting that discriminatory these discriminatory ads to be posted. What I thought was interesting, kind of going over this case, is it's been proven that if you open up a Facebook account within 60 clicks of likes or just visiting different sites, that site, they can tell nearly everything about you. So we're talking down to emotional stability, whether or not you're an alcoholic, things like this. Like there's a lot of things that can be, that Facebook can find. So if you were feeling at all bad for them being sued, maybe that will cause you to reconsider. But what we're talking about generally in advertising is, a lot of times, before the advent of the internet, there were, print ads, publishing ads that indicated a preference, limitation, or had discriminatory language based on a protected class. So this applies to individuals or large multifamily housing entities that are placing ads, in papers or on Facebook, things like that, advertising agencies that are preparing ads, and then, as I said, newspapers and social media that are actually publishing the ads. Okay, and so this is an example of something that may look, kind of innocent if you're coming across it in on Facebook or in a newspaper. But we have an apartment for rent. They do say coupled preferred. So two bedroom, two bath, $1,500 a month. Living room has a fireplace, master bedroom, walk-in closet. Second bedroom makes for a great office. Hardwood floors, located in a quiet 10-story building, walking distance to Brown Line, historical architecture requiring neat renters who will maintain unit's appearance. So I know we're not interactive, but I'm wondering how many of you are saying that possibly, yes, this could be illegal. And it is. There's a lot of phrases and language here that could be seen as discriminatory. So a phrase like couple preferred could be, marital status, something like that, and maybe that's, covered by your state or your local government. The words quiet often mean that, children are not wanted in the unit. So using rooms as an office instead of a second bedroom kind of may denote that, children are not wanted in the building too, and that could be a familial status claim. And then the last two sentences I kind of tweaked to maybe, discuss for people with disabilities. So, seeing a walking distance to a Brown Line. And it just kind of, these little things that maybe hint that they're looking for somebody that is not disabled. So historical architecture, neat renters, maybe people are thinking, I don't want you damaging walls or floors. Or can denote that I'm not interested in making any modifications, to this walk-up. So maybe you need not apply if you're a person with a disability. Okay, and so some of the protections for people with disabilities, I'm sure everybody's aware of. So the landlord that we're talking about must allow reasonable accommodations. And, we've heard reasonable accommodations versus reasonable modifications. Accommodations, of course, are talking about rules, policies, practices, or services. And so a big one that we'll talk about later, too, is support animals that are allowed in a building which typically does not allow pets. And then we have reasonable modifications, that persons with disabilities should be allowed to make these modifications to their unit and or common areas so that they can use the housing. And so we see things like maybe installing a ramp that wasn't there, grab bars in a bathroom, removing sink cabinets or maybe a cabinet, either in the bathroom or in the kitchen, enlarging doorways, maybe installing signage, things like that. And so the type of housing, as we'll get into too, depends on who's paying for the modifications. And I know today we're talking, I'm sorry, I switched to slide 23. We're talking today about the Fair Housing Act, but there are additional protections for people with disabilities. So if you're living in public housing or housing that's somehow subsidized by the federal government, while it's covered by the Fair Housing Act, it's also covered by Section 504 and ADA. So if a landlord is somehow receiving federal assistance, so as we said, maybe, this is directly to a housing authority or the housing authority or multifamily housing, things like that, they are then required to make and pay for reasonable modifications to the common areas and the units for the person with a disability. And now privately, that's not the case. So if you are renting from somebody, they don't have to pay for your modification, but if it's reasonable, they do have to allow you or, you know, whomever you're getting the money from, maybe it's a grant or, you know, another government entity that's coming in and making the modifications, they have to allow those modifications to take place. So getting into that, kind of going off on the modification route first, there are accessibility guidelines that are attached to the Fair Housing Act. And so those started and are applicable to new buildings with four or more units. And this is sometimes, you know, this will get us when we're looking into things in larger cities that are older. But the date of first occupancy has to be on or after March 13th of 91. Single-family homes and townhouses are not covered. If you are building a development that has elevators, and this is all language here that's important, all units must be usable by people with disabilities. So we're not talking full accessibility, but must be usable by people with disabilities. If you don't have an elevator, we're looking at only ground floors, ground floor units to be usable by people with disabilities. And what we've seen a lot lately, especially in cities, Chicago being one, is that maybe you have a first floor that has retail. If that happens, then the second floor becomes the floor that has to be accessible to person with disabilities. Okay. And so on slide 25, it gets kind of into the minutia of what we're looking for, what exactly the guidelines say. So I think it's important because a lot of people, even though we're very far into having these, out there, many people don't know what these look like. So the Fair Housing Act accessibility guidelines. So these are, you know, probably, I would say, in the scheme of all the accessibility guidelines, these are the easiest, the broadest, not as strict as when you get into accessibility guidelines under, you know, if you're using the ADAG or you're using UFAS, but we'll go through some of these. So we need at least one accessible building entrance. It has to be on an accessible route with wide enough doors. And so we're looking at entrance doors that are 36 inches, but throughout the entire unit, we're looking at 32. Common areas need to be accessible. So, we've actually gone out and done a lot of site visits where you see more and more amenities. So all of those things need to be accessible. Maybe you have a party room or we've seen rooftop party rooms, balconies, laundry rooms. a big thing that we keep seeing are mailboxes that are not, within accessible range. So you also need an accessible route into and through the unit. Light switches, thermostats, things like that. So we're looking at all environmental controls to be within reach range. And then something that's very hard to see, unless you're kind of demolishing something, but we look at, drawings and plans for buildings, is that there's reinforcement behind bathroom walls. And so that's a misconception a lot of times, is that grab bars need to be installed in units under Fair Housing Act, and that's not true, but there needs to be reinforcement there just in case somebody were to need grab bars installed. And then we're talking about usable kitchens and bathrooms. So, we look at kind of the footprint of a wheelchair and see if somebody in a wheelchair would be able to, fully turn around in these areas. So if you have a galley kitchen or you have, a smaller bathroom, if somebody in a wheelchair can use these rooms. And I'm sure you guys are all, so interested in this. I hope I'm not boring you. But I want you to kind of look at these common violations that we're seeing in design and construction. And I hope you notice that nearly all of the guidelines that I just went over are things that we see that are commonly violated. So, we're 30 years into having these guidelines, and we're still seeing things built incorrectly. So, which signals to us that many builders either still don't know the codes or simply don't care about the codes. So some of the things that we've seen on site are, sloping ramps, cracked and broken concrete that make an accessible entrance, impossible. Accessible and usable common areas sometimes don't exist. So even in places where we go and we'll see a management office, which is kind of the first step in somebody going to rent an apartment, are not accessible. So usable doors, this is a huge issue with thresholds. So while we get a lot of people argue that, maybe they put a storm door on or something to kind of battle the elements, the threshold may be up to 2 inches or more, which makes it impossible for somebody using a wheelchair to enter. So we also see threshold issues going into a shower, that may make it impossible for somebody to transfer into a shower, that there's not accessible routes into and throughout the unit. I've seen kind of ridiculous things where light switches may be completely out of reach range. Thermostats and other environmental controls that are out of, somebody who is using a wheelchair's reach. We're living in a time where a lot of things can be, put on a remote control, and we don't even see that sometimes when we go on site visits. So one thing that we do see a lot is just the absence of, that reinforcement that we were talking about for the grab bars. And again, this just seems like a list from the other page, but kitchens and bathrooms that are just not usable. And so I did put a list of resources that you can take time and look at if you ever feel like it. But what we were talking about is there's so many different standards, and it's very technical what falls under what guidance. So I think just remember, like I had said before, what's covered under the Fair Housing Act, and those things that are covered there. If you are a person who is, living in a multifamily residence or public housing, then you have to know that that's covered by Section 504. And that most things are covered by the ADA. So there's a lot of things out there that, while we may be giving you kind of just like ground level of accessibility guidance, there may be even more things that builders or owners have to do to be in compliance with building codes. Okay, so Peter and I had talked, and we thought it would be a good idea to discuss some topics that FHEO is currently kind of experiencing like an influx of in disability discrimination. So I'm on slide 28, and I don't think it would be a surprise to anybody that one of those topics is service animals. So what we're looking at for service animals are, you know, that that terminology, that they're animals, that they're not pets. And so they're aids to a person with a disability and not just their pet. So they're not subject to the general rules and fees, you know, that a landlord may typically put on somebody with a pet. And so as we know, and this is a topic of conversation a lot, such animals cannot be rejected because they lack of specialized training. So in housing, we're talking about, under the Fair Housing Act, there does not have to be a certification that the animal is trained to perform any kind of services for you. This comes up a lot, too. The animal does have to receive its shots, so it's rabies shots and things like that. If, you know, the state, usually we defer to them on what, you know, they're looking for as far as keeping an animal, and sometimes they'll have to be, like, spayed or neutered. So that will, you know, that will have to happen. You have to be in compliance with state or local law. And then really, just because you have a service animal does not mean that you're not going to be held responsible for things like, you know, picking up waste and things like that. So the owner's animal, you take responsibility for that animal, that it has to be restrained, that the waste is properly disposed of, you know, that they're not barking at all hours of the day and night. And so we're really looking that the animal, while it's helping somebody with a disability, is not interfering with other people's right to quiet enjoyment. And so then you also look at damages to the unit that may be above and beyond normal wear and tear. And depending on what that is, a person with a service animal may be responsible for that. You couldn't ask for a better resource than Department of Justice and Fair Housing issued a joint statement, which goes over pretty much any question you would have about service animals. So I would refer you to that if you had other questions that I didn't cover. Another thing that we have come across a lot are maybe people with psychiatric or mental disorders that housing providers consider direct threats and may just arbitrarily say, you know, this person has X, Y, or Z. Maybe they're a person, you know, who has schizophrenia, and somehow they, you know about the diagnosis and then just discriminate based upon, you know, knowing that diagnosis. And so what we look for is, you know, people have to do a direct threat analysis. And so what that is you look at it if a person poses a direct threat to others, and that has to be based on objective evidence. So, you know, their current conduct or, you know, maybe something that happened in the past. But there has to be objective evidence. It's not just that, you know, a person has a disability. So the assessment has to consider the nature, duration, and severity of the risk of injury, probability that injury will occur, and whether any accommodation would eliminate the threat. So we hear it a lot when people say, you know, that person's off their meds or things like that. And people may say it almost jokingly, but a lot of times if that's an accommodation that would mediate, you know, a situation, that has to be considered in a direct threat analysis. So, you know, has that person ever received, you know, treatment, or are they on medication? You know, there has to be an assessment done. You can't just, you know, blanketly tell somebody they can't live there because you consider them a threat. Everything has to have evidence behind it. I feel like I'm rushing through it, so I apologize. You can ask me questions about it at the end if I am. But I switched to slide 30. And I think kind of routinely something that comes up are live-in aids in housing. So there is a HUD defined there is a HUD definition for what a live-in aid is. So it's a person who resides with one or more elderly persons or near elderly persons or persons with disabilities. And so that person is essential to the care and well-being of the person, not obligated for the support of the person. There's always a question about that language, and that means financially. So, you know, you're not moving somebody in because you can't afford the rent anymore, and would not be living in the unit except to provide the necessary supportive services. So that kind of ties back to, you know, someone's daughter comes back from college, you know, and there's a rule, maybe the building has a rule that there's no more lease additions, you know, just for family members or something like that. And someone says, oh, that's going to be my live-in aid now. Well, you know, if they're not needed to provide the necessary supportive services, and they wouldn't, then they would ordinarily be living there for other reasons, they wouldn't be able to be the live-in aid. So tenants with live-in aids are subject to special rules. Like I talked about, we never look at live-in aids' income or their credit because it doesn't matter. Housing agencies, they have to ensure that a live-in aid is necessary for the support of a person with a disability before excluding his or her income. So that's what we talked about a little bit, like if someone's daughter's coming, you know, is it just that you want to live there or are you actually providing services? So that's when we get into kind of getting certification from medical providers or other knowledgeable professionals that somebody would need a live-in aid. And that goes directly into the last point. So the housing agency generally requires the applicant or resident to document the necessity for live-in aid. So I have never seen somebody get granted a live-in aid that hasn't gone through a process of having it certified by a provider first. Okay, and so this last slide, 31, we talked a little bit about, you know, if you feel like you've been discriminated against, about filing a fair housing complaint. And so there's so many ways to do that now. All are free. So I included the website that you can go to file an online complaint. So you can do it online. You can do it by phone. Phone numbers are at the bottom, including the TTY number. And then you can always walk in and actually file an in-person complaint with your local HUD office. So I think hopefully I didn't talk too quickly, Peter, but I think that's the end of my slides.
All right. Well, it gives us lots of time for lots of questions that we have for you, Amanda. So sit back. Sydney, if you could come on and give instructions for our telephone participants on how they can ask questions at this time, please.
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star, then 1 on your telephone. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please stand by while we compile the Q&A roster.
All right, and while we're waiting for that, Amanda, if you could just provide a clarification on who's considered a housing provider under, you know, subject to the Fair Housing Act, because we get some questions, and we've had questions here about, you know, condos association, homeowners associations, and so forth. And
sure.
What are the very limited, you know, exceptions? I think you talked about it briefly, but if you could just go over that again.
So that's something that we encounter a lot. Our, you know, homeowners association, and we have seen a lot of complaints, and they are, you know, what you would consider. They may not be the actual housing provider, but since they have rules in place. Those are subject to reasonable accommodation and modification. It follows generally the same process as all other complaints. So they're not the homeowner association is not exempt from fair housing. We're talking more about, say, you move into, it's always called the Mrs. Murphy law, where you have like a little old lady that's, renting out the upstairs unit. Those are areas where, it's not applicable. But very definitely we see homeowners associations that, if you're being asked by one of your residents to, we've seen anything from people with, MS or ALS, rheumatoid arthritis, asking for, outdoor hot tubs to be installed because that's the only thing that, alleviates pain, things like that. And those are complaints that we take. So hopefully, and providers in general, we're talking about if you're, if you're using a Section 8 voucher, so your landlord, that's your provider, but they may not, under that program, they don't pay for your modifications, which is different from, a public housing authority, which would have to pay for your modifications if you're living in their housing. So it's sometimes complicated, but if you have questions about that, you can call and we can lead you through that. So I hope it clears it up a little bit, but you can refer to that slide, and if it's a gray area, we can definitely look into it for you or help you.
Okay, and then there was a follow-up there. Is there some language in the Fair Housing Act that you had talked about when you were defining, someone that has rents three single-family homes or fewer is not covered? Is there also another piece of that where they don't use a real estate agent or they don't advertise that also plays into that exception, or is it simply three single-family homes or fewer?
No, there is more information in the Act that does specify use through, because you can find different different parties liable for this mm-hmm. discrimination. So, perhaps you used a real estate agent. We've had cases, complaints against the agent who, mainly we're talking about steering and things like that. But if somebody is bringing you to a particular place and you experience discrimination there, they can be liable for a complaint.
Okay, and just for clarification, we talked about that single family homes are exempt; they're not subject to the Fair Housing Act accessibility guidelines. Mm-hmm. But in that instance, if there was a homeowners association for that neighborhood of single family homes, the homeowners association would still be covered by the Fair Housing Act itself.
That's right.
In that situation, okay.
That's right.
Okay. Well, as long as we're on that, I'm going to go ahead with a couple questions around that area, homeowners associations. And if you could just talk, it's specific questions about, a family that had made a request to a rule regarding, the types of fences that could be installed in a neighborhood, and a family has a child with autism, and the home, and so they wanted to install a fence for safety for the child.
Sure.
Who is a risk for running away. And then another example where someone talked about where this was a another homeowners association, and an individual wanted to make an alteration to the exterior to make some changes for a mobility disability, and was denied. And the premise was that it doesn't fit the architectural design of the the fit of the neighborhood. So if you could talk about those two specific examples, and just in general of homeowners associations and their obligations to, I guess those would fall under reasonable, I guess, both modifications and accommodations, I guess.
Sure. And so what we're talking about here, a lot of times, so to clarify too, because I'm sure that would be a question, they're not paying for it. So by they, I mean the homeowners association. But if somebody were to walk in and say exactly what you just said, you know, I have a child with autism, if, you know, we want to build a fence, you know, for their safety, and, you know, they outright, you know, come back and just say no, then that is, you know, what we would look at and say, you know, discriminatory, because that is not considered, you know, you've failed to provide a reasonable accommodation. And, you know, eventually, I mean, we've conciliated a lot of cases where maybe they started out not being responsible to pay, but they are, because, you know, you've violated the law. So what we're looking for, and like, I know it's, and I hope, I don't know if anybody is part of a, if they are the homeowners association that are listening, but may not be kind of the best people you want to negotiate stuff with, but, you know, there has to be, and I'm sure everyone's heard about, like, an interactive process. So I may want XYZ, you know, this type of fence and whatever, and the homeowner says, or homeowners association says no, they still need to talk with you and maybe figure out something that maybe you want to put in, what is it, the cyclone fencing, but they'd rather have you do, you know, something that looks like wrought iron, something like this. There needs to be a conversation before it's just outright, you know, denied that's going to happen. So I'm trying to think of what else I'd want to, because we've seen so many things, you know, up to, and a lot of it, like you're saying, is just about appearance. So, you know, people that want to add ramps, but are told no, and these are violations, and that's something you should, if not contact HUD about, then contact, you know, maybe your local, you know, Department of Human Rights about, if you do have that. But those are things that they just can't blanketly say no to.
Okay. So a couple follow-ups on that. With regards to homeowners association, condo associations, where I guess more often for condo associations you have some sort of management company. By extension, are they subject to the FHA, or because they're working on behalf of the condo association, you know, they're subject to the FHA if they're the, you know, the face that, you know, that residents interact with to make requests in a condo setting?
Yeah, that's a great question, and absolutely. And so when we would take a complaint, we would include both parties normally on something like that. You know, who owns the property, who's managing the property. That's something we probably would file against both.
And in that instance, for the, you know, the condo association folks, it's incumbent that they have that they identify management companies that are knowledgeable of, you know, Fair Housing Act
exactly,
requirements,
yeah,
and so forth.
And there's enough, you know, even free training out there, or, you know, Google it and watch a video or something. There's actually, like, at this point, like, no excuse, you know, to some things that we're still seeing. So, you know, HUD provides funding for, you know, other agencies to go out and kind of, you know, do trainings and do, you know, educate homeowners and landlords and things like that. So, you know, really at this point, there's not an excuse for not knowing some of these things.
That. Okay. Okay. A couple questions. I'm going to put these together. So, and you touched on this, but if you could just to clarify again. So, are residents responsible for the cost of reasonable modifications? And I know you've got a qualifier on that. And then another question that someone submitted was, does a private landlord participating in a Section 8 program responsible for the cost of reasonable modifications?
Okay, two good questions. And what I always tell people is, normally, if you're if you can trace the funding for your housing, so let's say the easiest one, if you live in public housing that is federally subsidized, and so the person that owns that housing is responsible for paying for that modification. There's a little tweak on that when you're using a housing choice voucher, in that, yes, some of your rent, you know, is subsidized by the government, but you are renting from a private landlord who is not responsible for paying for your modification. And so a lot of times you'll see some larger housing authorities actually put together modification funds because they know that a lot of people with disabilities are using vouchers. So I would, you know, that's kind of a recommendation is for somebody to reach out if they are on a voucher to see if, you know, funds like that exist. But those are things when you are on a voucher, that is something that you are responsible for paying for. And normally some of the things, if you're in multifamily housing, so, you know, we're talking about some of the bigger developments, those are subsidized by the federal government. And so the management or the owner is responsible for paying for that modification. You know, the twist becomes if you're out on a voucher, the funding is just paying for the rent. It's not paying for, you know, that actual unit. So you're basically, you're renting from a private landlord who is not responsible for paying for that modification. That being said, if you can pay for it and you have a way to, you know, get that modification in, they have to let that modification happen. So they can't say, you know, a ramp is ugly and I don't want it, you know, on my building, or an automatic door opener, you know, brings down the curb appeal or whatever they're going to say. And that's where they can, you know, get in trouble for discrimination with modifications.
Sorry, muted myself. As a follow-up to that, Amanda, can, for instance, you know, a condo association, let's say that a resident is requesting to be able to allow to install automatic door openers at an exterior door they need it, or on the unit. You know, as part of that interactive process, can the condo association / management company, you know, have some requirements in terms of using, you know, a contractor that, you know, has appropriate, you know, insurance or credentials, or, you know, that the work be done in a, that they'll allow it, but there are certain, you know, provisions to installing the, you know, in this instance, the a power door opener.
Sure. Yeah, that actually is, you know, where it's not the homeowner that's putting it in is, you know, a lot of times you would see, like, I can, you know, save costs. If my daughter needs a ramp, I'll put it in, or things like that. No, they, you know, sometimes they will ask, like, and they are entitled to do that, like, for plans and things like that. So if you're putting a fence in, like, not just a drawing on where you're putting the fence in, but actually having, you know, maybe licensed and insured fencing company come out and draw it up for you. And I should say this too, another caveat to that is, in private housing, there is the expectation there that once you leave that unit, that unit be brought back to the same condition it was in, you know, before you were there. So if there is a ramp, and say the landlord, you know, has always thought it was ugly and they want it gone, that's also the tenant's responsibility to, you know, have it returned to the same condition it was in before they were there. So, you know, I haven't personally seen anything like that where, you know, somebody's done all this work. And a lot of times it's a good thing because maybe a landlord will go out and, you know, and look for somebody with a disability that can use that. But that's something that they can, you know, they can make that expectation.
If you can, there was a question about that, so I'm glad that you touched on that.
Okay.
About so let me give you the example that someone had submitted was someone installs grab bars in a bathroom by the toilet in the bathtub. You know, is that something that where a landlord housing provider could require that tenant upon leaving to restore, you know, that type of installation?
Unfortunately, you know, normally because I don't want to appear biased, but I am usually on the side of, you know, somebody who would need it. Yeah, they can require that. Whatever it says in their lease, like however they put that, you know, they can enforce that. And it is within some of the statutes too, that, you know, use that language, you know, what the condition of, you know, the unit before the modifications were made is you know, how it should be returned when somebody is moving out.
Okay, great. You talked about, you know, and gave context for filing complaints, the Fair Housing Act hotline, the 800-669-9777. Someone wanted to know if you could, you know, give a brief overview. You know, oftentimes, you know, folks know that they can file a complaint. They're given a telephone number. But what does that actually look like? So from, you know, the moment that, let's say, someone calls the Fair Housing Act hotline, they talk to someone at HUD, and they begin that complaint process, what does that look like, and what in terms of expectations, what can they be? What can someone that thinks they've been discriminated against on the basis of disability, you know, what's the turnaround time for HUD to actually accept the complaint, investigate it, and, you know, come up with some type of resolution?
Well, I don't know how many people I've worked with the government before, but we're not the quickest people. And usually there's a reason for that. So I don't mean to be, joking about it, but this is normally what happens. So we'll receive a call. You usually talk to one of our intake analysts, and what they are tasked with doing is looking to see if the complaint is jurisdictional. So, for example, is it something we can look at? Does it fall under one of those protected classes that we keep going over? Is it within timelines? Is it, is one of those exemptions, applicable there? So they go through and they look at all of that. They listen to what happened and write that up and do the first step of kind of like investigating that. So they'll find out who, you know, a lot of times people won't know, like, I don't know who owns this house, you know, and they'll do property searches to figure, you know, all that out. As you were saying, like with a homeowners association or with there was a realtor involved or something, they get all that information, about who is going to be the respondent to the complaint. So who we're actually looking at that has liability for the discriminatory act. So they do all that. That can take some time. We investigate, then we investigate all the claims. If it's something kind of straightforward, so say, I keep picking on housing authorities, but say it's, you know, I live at Cuyahoga Housing Authority, then we would know right away, okay, this is, you know, who owns it, things like that. That could be pretty quick. But we're going to need, they go back and forth with the complainant. So they want to make sure everything that they heard is right. They're going to send the complaint to the person that is making the complaint and have them sign off on it. And then after that, it's assigned internally to an investigator who is going to start the process of, you know, finding out what actually happened there. So talking to complainant again, getting their side of, you know, the events, and then interacting with the respondent. So, you know, whomever we found is, liable in that situation. So, normally we ask for, it could be straightforward. We don't see that a lot. A lot of times there's going to be a lot of data requests going back and forth. So, you know, like I said, doesn't happen very often where someone just says to somebody, like, I'm not renting to you because you're black. We may have to go back and get demographics, just see if, you know, how other people were treated in similar situations. Typically I would say about 6 months. And that's, I would say that's good, honestly.
Okay.
We've seen some that are still ongoing that are, you know, a year plus. It really is, especially since we're on the subject of homeowners associations, especially things that are more complicated like that. So people that may not be very interested in settlement or, you know, conciliating the problem. And that's our number one thing. What we try to do is, you know, I don't think anyone wants to move, you know. So if we can, you know, really get a settlement that works for both parties and somebody gets to stay where they're currently living, I think that's a win. A lot of times we'll come in when it's, you know, actually already happened where a person's been evicted or, you know, something like that. And then, you know, it's all kind of, you know, case by case what we're looking at. But I would say, you know, even just getting the complaint finalized may take, you know, maybe about a month.
With that, is there the right of private action under the Fair Housing Act? So instead of filing a complaint, does someone have the ability to bring legal action in court?
Sure.
Under
the
Fair Housing Act? Okay. Thank you.
I mean, and there's some things like once, you know, if we find something or not, like somebody can, you know, unless we've conciliated it and kind of ended mm-hmm. it, you know, person can kind of withdraw and they can do their own thing.
In other instances, Amanda, where a HUD office may refer a complainant or someone that's contacted about filing a complaint to a state agency or even a local county or city human rights where someone may have greater protections or greater recourse under that local statute?
So that's a great question because that happens a lot. And so we do make referrals a lot to – you know, if you hear something that, you know, maybe, like I said, the Illinois Department of Human Rights can do it or, like, City of Chicago can look into it. And then we actually have what we were talking about a little bit earlier, where we consider some agencies substantially equivalent to HUD. And so they will actually take, you know, a pretty fair chunk of cases. And they investigate them just as we would. So they're looking at it, you know, how it applies, how the Fair Housing Act applies, and they do that entire investigation. And once that comes through, you know, they take care of it. So they investigate it, and I couldn't give you a good ratio of, you know, mm-hmm. what that looks like, but a really fair amount of cases will go to those agencies.
Okay. A couple of questions on Fair Housing Act accessibility guidelines. Well, before I get to that, let me ask you my own quick question here.
Sure.
Do you have any knowledge about HUD's moving forward with updating the Fair Housing Act accessibility guidelines?
Well, not to be
probably
too,
not, but
right, not to be too controversial, but I wouldn't expect anything, you know,
okay.
in the
All right.
next couple of years.
All right. Okay, so a question, a couple questions here on Fair Housing Act accessibility guidelines. So one wants to know about, you know, sidewalks on a property. So an apartment complex, you know, are sidewalks covered by the Fair Housing Act accessibility guidelines, you know, on a complex where you have multiple, let's say, apartment buildings that then these sidewalks connect the buildings and to the clubhouse. And then the second one is clarification. I think something that you touched on during your presentation was, you know, for instance, an apartment clubhouse, you know, that has a fitness center, it has a business center, it has a party room, it also has a swimming pool with changing rooms and stuff. Are all of those areas covered by the accessibility guidelines, and are they required to be accessible?
And I'm another good question. So, like, short answer, yes. So, yes, if they are offering, you know, common area amenities, those all have to be accessible. And that just is. So that's period. If they're doing, you know, you have a common bathroom, there has to be, you know, that has to be accessible. Like to change your rooms, there has to be a shower that's accessible for a person who is, you know, using a mobility aid. Doors. So a lot of times it'll be something just like door pressure, things like that. We really are looking for like the whole thing to be accessible. So the sidewalk issue, what we do, and I'll just tell you what we do when we normally go on site after we receive a complaint, and that is we, you know, we use what they have deemed the accessible route to kind of take us throughout the entire development. So if I live, you know, in one building, there should be an accessible route for me to get to the laundry facility that may be, you know, a couple buildings away. And typically, I mean, we'll walk that. Sometimes we'll have a person that's using a wheelchair come with to see, you know, if it's usable. But the entire time you're kind of looking for, you know, slope issues, or like somebody said, if it's cracked and unusable, you know, then of course that's not an accessible route. So, but if it's something, if they can establish that there is an accessible route to common areas, or, you know, that from a unit, if you're somewhere and it's not what they've deemed the accessible route, and it's, say it's, you know, cracked sidewalk or things like that, that's kind of iffy. That's, you know, they should fix it anyway. Not even for somebody that's, you know, even just using a wheelchair, but, you know, for everybody that's in the complex. But, you know, that's something that's...
Hold on, sure, 1 second, Amanda.
Sure.
We're going to pause here for 1 second. We've lost our audio to the webinar platform. So, Sydney?
Yes.
We lost our telephone, dropped to the webinar room. So Claudia Diaz is going to be calling in again to make that connection. If you can look for her, she's on hold right now. If you can pick up that call, please.
Okay, will do.
Thanks for your patience for our folks on the telephone. We're just reconnecting with our participants in the webinar platform, so we appreciate your patience. And we are back connected. So, and I apologize, Amanda.
I think I babble, but I was talking about like if.
Oh, you were talking about sidewalks.
Yeah, yes. If we're away from the accessible route that's been established. You know, I would just think that that's a good business to, you know, to have it corrected for all residents. But, you know, really that's what we're looking at when we, you know, just talking in terms of once we've received a complaint and we come out, you know, we're looking at accessible routes mainly.
Before we get any further, let's get into service and assistance animals here. So, which here at the ADA National Network is something that we get lots of questions on. So whether this is a housing provider, a housing authority, a condo association, what type of documentation can a housing provider require from a resident that is seeking an accommodation to a no pet policy?
Sure. Okay. So, you know, we have all these laws that are kind of colliding when we're looking at assistance animals and emotional support animals, and where they are. So strictly speaking, we're talking about in your house, in your unit, what people are allowed to ask you for is what we talked about before, is that certification of need. So from your provider, you know, whomever is going to say that you need this animal for either, you know, maybe you need it for, you know, emotional support, as we said, or you need it as a service animal. That's what they are allowed to ask for. So they're not, and, you know, sometimes, you know, people get into it about there doesn't have to be a certification that animal is trained. Other things that they can ask you for are, kind of, you know, records of the inoculations, you know, going back, you know, to state and local kind of regulations, like if the animal is, like, spayed or neutered, things like that. So those are things they can ask for, but things they can't ask for is for that animal to have been trained and for you to have, you know, a certificate of, you know, that training.
of the training. And just for clarification, if they're asking for information about vaccinations, if it is a property that allows pets, that would have to be their policy across the board, right?
Absolutely.
You
right.
couldn't just ask it of service or assistance animals.
Absolutely right.
And is it correct that under the Fair Housing Act, that the terms that are used, again, we have the ADA and the definition of service animals, and we have the Air Carrier Access Act, and we have the Fair Housing.
Mm-hmm.
But under FHA, the terms are service and assistance animals. And if you could just talk about more what would fall under that latter category of an assistance animal.
Sure. So, what we're really looking at is, you can kind of see, the huge differences here of like how it's defined in different places. So as you just said, it just says, Fair Housing Act is assistance animal. So, if it's a cat or two cats or, maybe like watching fish helps you and that's your emotional, support animal that way, or you have, an iguana that you walk around with on a leash. I don't know, whatever falls underneath something that is helping you. That as long as it's not a dangerous animal, that's something that goes under Fair Housing Act. ADA has specific language that talks about, I believe it says just, it only says dog. And so that's something, really, those are the difference. Like if you were, where you're living, compared to something that you can kind of take on a bus or a plane or in a restaurant. So for your residents, it is the type of animal that is not dangerous, to anybody else, that is, and you can kind of follow the rest of, what's outlined there. So if it is a dog, as we said, that you're picking up after it and things like that. But they're under, the FHA, there's not such specificity, if I can talk, as there are under, ADA and things like that.
Yeah. And the ADA, it defines service animals or limit species to dogs only with modification for individually trained miniature horses. And so just to follow up on a couple different things there, Amanda, going back to the documentation, so documentation would be something along the lines, the housing provider would be limited to, let's say, for instance, documentation that indicates, one, that the resident has a disability as defined under FHA, and two, that what you talked about, that there's a disability need for the animal.
Exactly. So I know we're all familiar with the lingo or the, maybe it's more technical than just lingo, but, when we're talking about a nexus, so we're looking at the connection between a person just, that's all they need to know. They don't need to know what type of disability, the severity of the disability, but they're looking for person is disabled, and it makes sense, with a disability that they would need this accommodation so that they would need a service animal. And that is primarily what they can ask you. And that's what they're looking to establish.
Okay.
But shouldn't go any further than that.
Okay. Now, one thing that we hear from time to time here at the ADA National Network, from housing providers are these, and even for housing providers, these online websites where you can go and print out a certification documentation that your animal is X, whatever it is, you pay a certain amount of money and you can get that printed off from the website. Is that type of documentation, and maybe this is maybe too specific for you to address, but is that type of documentation something a housing provider would have to accept? Would that be considered documentation from an appropriate entity or an appropriate professional, however you want to phrase it?
You know what? I think that's a difficult one, but I think what they could still ask is, you see that all the time, that you get certification from another provider, somebody that actually has knowledge of your disability, and that's kind of goes with what we call them, knowledgeable professional. So, do they have knowledge of you being disabled, and do they have knowledge of you needing that assistance animal? So, really something that you printed off the internet, I would imagine that would be something you could probably fight with maybe, you know, other folks that are asking you for certification, you know, of the animal being trained, but that's not what providers are, you know, housing providers are looking for. They're looking for what we were talking about, the that there is somebody there that is telling them that it makes sense for you to have that animal. So we're looking for that nexus.
Yeah, and that was a great answer, and to highlight, because I think it really addresses the issue of those online websites you talked about. You know, someone that has knowledge of the person's disability, and B, someone that has knowledge of that disability need for the animal. And you know, with some places where that documentation comes from, there isn't going to be, you know, that knowledge of the mm-hmm. disability or the need for the animal. So that's a great way of putting it. Just because we're on a roll, let's continue on with the service and assistance animals. Are there instances where, and this is a question that we had submitted here and that we've gotten before, can the housing providers go back to a resident to get updated documentation once they've gone through the, you know, the process of getting the accommodation to a no pet policy? Can that landlord go back again and say, we want updated documentation?
No. A simple answer, no. No, once it's been established, that's it. That's enough. So, it's not part of, you know, even just looking at it technically from, you know, things that, you know, even if you're living in subsidized housing and you have to like recertify, you know, the whole recertification process, there are certain things that people need, and that's not one of them. So, you know, that's, short answer, no.
No. Okay. And then one last services or assistance animal, unless we get more in here. Does a visitor to, let's say, someone's going to visit someone that lives in a condo building and it's a no pet building. Can a visitor with a disability that uses a service animal, do they have, you know, rights to enter that no pet building, whether it's a condo or it's an apartment building?
I really like that question. We had a case. We took a case in where exact situation happened, where they denied someone access to a building because they had a service animal. And so, you know, people, your visitors, if you're a person with a, you know, even if you're not a person with a disability, if your visitor, you know, is a person with a disability, the act extends to them. So they, of course, can bring, you know, their service animal on property. And that's people will always ask you that because, you know, they don't know you. Like, if you're a visitor, they don't know you like they know their resident. But, you know, that's very definitely one of those things where I think, like, you were, you know, kind of talking about where we get into, like, oh, do you – if they're asking you if you have certificates and all this kind of stuff, and they can't. And so that's really one of those things, too, that, you know, I think – things like this are great, so we can kind of get out what people kind of cannot ask for.
And that may be a situation where the person that's going to visit, if they're aware of the no pet policy, may need to take steps to, you know, with the person they're going to visit or contacting the management company just to, you know, perhaps let them know in advance that they'll, you know, be visiting with a service or assistance animal to avoid any, you know, confusion or situations.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I promise. But one last question. This was something that you addressed when you presented previously on service and assistance animals. But can you talk about the application of the Fair Housing Act to local ordinances? So, you know, so a resident single family home and the local municipality says you know, a limit on the number of rabbits or we don't allow chickens. And the resident comes forward and says, these are my assistants, rabbits, chickens, whatever the case may be. What, how does the FHA apply in that type of scenario?
And yeah, so, you know, blanketly, they say that there's not, you know, there's not a limit, but we also operate in with that very like subjective term of reasonable. So, you know, if you have like 50 chickens, it may be an issue. And again, kind of going and taking like the easy way out, but it is kind of a case by case situation. If you have two cats, okay, and I know. you know, we're giving different examples because, you know, it says that there shall not be, you know, a limitation on, you know, size of animals, breed of animal. But really when you're talking about numbers, there has to be, you know, something for reasonableness there too. So I just remember one of the cases that I dealt with at the housing authority where we had small studios and a senior there needed an assistance animal but wanted two huge St. Bernards. And, you know, really just ended up being an issue of, you know, is it reasonable, is it practical to house, you know, a dog that's 180 pounds, you know, two of them with somebody in, you know, 500 square feet or whatever it was. And so a lot of those things, you know, it ends up having to be a conversation of what's going to be reasonable but also still, you know, be helpful to the person with a disability. So, but normally if the FHA is going to, you know, if we're talking about it is going to win out over what the local kind of guidelines are on things like that. They do defer to them, like I said, about, you know, shots and things like that. But, you know, just because they blanketly outlaw, you know, pit bulls or, you know, like shepherds and things like that, you know, there is a legitimate fight there with, you know, for filing a fair housing complaint.
Right. Okay, we're getting close to the bottom of the hour here. So one, just a quick, if you can, quick clarification on about caretakers, and someone wanted to know: does this mean if an adult family member cannot be a live-in caretaker?
No, and you know what? I think what I said, I was using an example that kind of got away from me. So what we're saying is, so here's some examples that people have seen. So I come in and I try to get, you know, my daughter on my lease. For whatever reason, like say it's a credit check or whatever it is, no, she can't come in. Say you hear that. And then the person comes the next day and they say, I want my daughter to be my live-in aide, not a family member. And then you know that we don't, you know, take in consideration credit and things like that. That would be an instance where they say, hey, if, you know, this person would be living in your unit, you know, not to provide services, just to be a family member. So that's kind of where I was getting at. What I'm saying is, you know, the things that they can ask for are that same thing we were going over. You have a disability and you need somebody to provide you services. And so it could be, you know, and that's where the housing provider needs to kind of butt out a little bit. It could be, you know, whomever you deem, you know, able to give you those services. So, you know, your daughter, your son, things like that. But, you know, I've seen it too many times where somebody, you know, does something that's similar to that. But I did not mean to make it sound like an adult family member couldn't, for sure. And that's normally who ends up being, you know, a live-in aide.
Okay. One last one real quick. We're at the bottom of the hour. Just effective communication, online applications, online payment systems covered by FHA, right? For a resident that may be blind, uses assistive technology, you know, there would be a need for either that being accessible or the housing provider making some type of accommodation.
Absolutely. Yep. Just request it. You just have to ask for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. All right. Well, we have reached the bottom of the hour. We still had more questions to go, but we have reached the end. want to thank Amanda not just for the time that she has spent with us for the 90 plus minutes, but all of her time in preparing for the session. So we really appreciate that. We appreciate all of you joining us today. You know, the participants are the reasons why we do these sessions. Encourage you to do complete the evaluation of the session that helps us for planning future sessions, so we need that feedback. a note on the next session, which will kick off the 2019-2020. We're into a new decade, or the end of this decade. I don't know how that works. I can't remember. All right. So, but a note on that October session, that will be on October the 8th. So that is a different date. We typically do these on the third Tuesday of the month. It is the second Tuesday, October the 8th, and we will be talking about understanding the Disability Equality Index. So as we get into National Disability Employment Month, we're going to have a representative from Disability in doing a session on that. You can find information on registering for that session, and there are other sessions up on the ada-audio.org website. If you have questions, contact us at 877-232-1990. Today's session has been recorded and edited. Our archive will be posted within a couple of weeks. Again, thanks to our speaker, Amanda. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Good luck, everyone, and enjoy the remainder of your Tuesday. Thanks and good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.